Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. How does the latest St. Louis Public Radio We Live Here contributor feel about her new home, St. Louis? We'll find out a little bit later. But first, we all know how noted playwright Tennessee Williams felt about this town. He spent much of his youth here and apparently hated it. As many biographers have pointed out now there's another study of Williams' life, and it's being reviewed as probably the best of all of them. The author is John Lahr, award-winning author and longtime drama critic at The New Yorker magazine. His 2014 book, Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, is now out in paperback. His most recent book is Joyride, Show People and Their Shows. I spoke with John Lahr earlier this morning. So nice to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Delightful.
You know, I'd like to start with something we read so much about concerning Tennessee Williams in St. Louis, the fact that he apparently loathed the place. Why?
Well, he loathed it, I think, because he had such a miserable childhood here. His family was at war, and they literally drove their children crazy. One is, everybody knows, Rose had one of the earliest prefrontal lobotomies. And Tennessee, who was not crazy then, was certainly very handicapped by the constant battle between the parents and his mother's frigidity and his father's violence. So it was a recipe for disaster, and it was.
And how did he ultimately work some of that into his
Well, first of all, you know, he referred to St. Louis as Saint Pollution. He worked it. What my book does, and Tennessee said that he wanted to paint a picture of his heart, and that his plays were a picture of that heart at the time of the writing. So as his heart flowered and blossomed and atrophied and declined, the plays really reflect this shift, this internal shift in him, and they are really. He wrote 70 plays, and they're astoundingly astute and uncanny in how he could imagine problems that he had and then reconfigure them in stories, you know. So if you read the plays, you see his moral and imaginative transformation and as he declines, you know. Oscar Wilde called a writer's life a long, lovely suicide. And in Williams, the battles for life and death were always in contention. And over time, I think through exhaustion and because he was a chronically chronic alcoholic and did a lot of drugs, I mean, someone who did a study of his drug intake, referred to him as the pharmacology of the lost. The dark side took over, and his plays chronicle that. But taken as a whole, the plays represent an extraordinary landscape of American individualism, which I think is really interesting because Williams. You could read Williams' life. I don't in the book, but you could extrapolate from it. Post-war America, an allegory of it. I mean, because here was a man who dedicated everything to the pursuit of his greatness and a huge potential, who lost his way. And ultimately, I think he would say, became barbarous. And, you know, it's quite interesting to see how these forces, which were forces in the society, also contended in him.
You probably just answered this next question, but I have to ask what drew you to him. I mean, obviously a very complex, interesting guy.
Oh, that's a good question, and it's complicated. I became the drama critic of The New Yorker in 1992, I mean, I had a wonderful 21-year run, so that Joyride is really my Joyride too, because it's an envoi to that period.
We'll talk about that in a little
bit. Yeah, when I got the job, I intended and did use The New Yorker as a bully pulpit for both Williams and Odets, who at the time. had been low rated in the critical debate, which was ridiculous, partially because of the failure of the late plays of Williams, partially because he was gay and there was a certain homophobia in the critical press. And I liberated my first profile in The New Yorker, which was written in 1993, I believe. I've written over 40, so that'll tell you how long ago it was, liberated the first volume of what was to be a two-volume biography of Tennessee Williams by a man called Lyle Leverage. And that book was called Tom, which took Williams' story up to Glass Menagerie.
His first name is?
Is Tom Williams, yeah, sorry. And what happened is an extraordinary story in itself, because the estate, he wrote the book, but the estate wouldn't let it be published. And the mischievous so-called trustee that the estate let represent it was a woman called Lady Maria St. Just, neither a lady nor a saint nor just, as I pointed out. Really put the kibosh on it, and he came to me and asked me if I would perhaps do a profile that might help shift things. Well, a profile at The New Yorker is a 3-month job of about 10,000 words, and I did my own reporting. And at the end of it, I had so much on this woman, and it was a never-ending tale of infamy what the estate got up to, that in order to put a good spin on what was going to be a kind of it turned out to be a sensational story. The lawyers representing Williams said, "Let Leverage's book be published." It was published. It did very well. Lyle had never written a book, although Williams had authorized him to do it. He just liked him, and Lyle and I became friends, and he said, look, if anything happens to me, he was a much older man, would you finish? And I said, sure. And then 2 years later, he went and died. And he had actually put my name in the will. But I had a whole other take on Williams. I didn't like Lyle's psychological interpretation of the family, which I thought was naive. And the thing about – we actually talked about this – Lyle was not a theater critic, didn't know the history of the theater particularly, always a producer, and he wasn't interested in interpretation. He was just trying to get the story straight, and it was a good story, and he did it well. But when the curtain comes down on the Glass Menagerie, the 26 curtain calls that it got, Tom Williams is Tennessee Williams, and on a first-name basis with the world for the rest of his life. The spotlight never leaves him, so he's famous. So as a writer, the narrative challenge is extraordinarily hard. That is to say, you have a public life, a private life, and you have this extraordinary body of work, which includes the plays, 70 he wrote, but an awful lot of really good poems and short stories. So you're juggling the work, the man, and the celebrity, and also, you have to, as a biographer, unless you want to write a really dull biography, you have to impose an interpretation on all this. What does it mean? All this stuff that's out there. And my game is putting the writers, the biography is only writ large what I do in the profiles in Joyride, which is to try to put the work in the context of the culture and impose meaning on all this stuff. What does it mean? It's not enough just to say the plots of the plays, which is what you do in ordinary reviews. This is what happened. But what does this mean? What is he getting at? How does it relate to the life and the culture? Williams and the plays are metaphors. I mean, Williams invented himself. So the metaphors are there to be interpreted, to played with, see where it takes you in the culture, and that's my game.
We're going to have to take a short break here now. We'll do that. We're talking with John Lahr, who is the author of the biography of Tennessee Williams, now out in paperback. It was actually out a couple of years ago in hardback, as I recall. And his latest book is Joyride. We'll talk about that a little bit too, but we'll be back after this very short break. And welcome back. With me in studio is John Lahr, who is the author of Tennessee Williams, the biography of Tennessee Williams. And his latest book is Joyride. We'll be talking about that in a couple of moments. But John Lahr, let me come back to Tennessee Williams. You met him one time, I understand. Is that correct?
Yeah. For a brief time in the 70s, I was the literary manager of Lincoln Center. And the first production we did was Camino Real, a revival with Al Pacino as Kilroy. And Tennessee came to the opening night, and it was quite shocking to me as a young guy who just lionized Williams. He literally had to be lifted into his seat. He was legless, just blitzed, and it was shocking. But you see, I think in the latter years, you know, the whole point of Williams was a hysteric. He called himself the definition of hysteria, 16 cylinders inside a jalopy, he said. And what hysterics do is they use their wound as lure to startle you, to attract attention, to control you. They make scenes. And when Williams' scenes on stage didn't draw people to him, which was really after 1966, he sometimes just acted out. He acted out his collapse in public. He would literally fall down. People would write about it. They would be startled. It was very disconcerting. He would fall down in restaurants. He even wrote a play about it in the bar of a Tokyo hotel. But it was all part of the same legend of his collapse, which in after the 50s, late mid-50s, was how he engineered continuing to write, because he found himself blocked. And what the drugs and drink did was, to a certain extent, allow him to he took himself to the brink psychologically so he could step back and report it, which works until it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You sort of cannibalize yourself. And he even wrote about that, because if you look – he called Suddenly Last Summer an allegory. And that's a story in which a man is eaten alive. And the person who actually was being eaten alive was Williams, who was eating himself alive to make meaning, you know, and that's what happened.
You know, he met Suddenly Last Summer. It just occurs to me that, of course, he was a playwright and an outstanding one for much of his life, not all of his life, but for much of his life. But I think most people got to know Tennessee Williams through film. I mean, all of his great plays made their way to film. I wonder what he thought about that.
Well, first of all, I have to say that the films are a very bad and often terribly skewed version of his plays. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to take the most successful of the films, Streetcar Named Desire, the whole meaning of the play is completely reversed in the film. In the film, I mean, Blanche is sacrificed so that her sister Stella and family can continue, so that the last image of the play is that is the sort of desire of the family to continue, the sort of selfishness asserts itself. The self and its aggrandizement asserts itself, which is a very hard message, but probably cynically true. Whereas in the movie, they wanted Stanley, who has raped Blanche, has to be punished. So at the end, Stella takes their child and goes upstairs and says essentially to Stanley, "You'll never see me again." So he's punished for his action, which is completely not the ambivalent point that Williams was making. And there, I mean, I think Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is very steamy, and one I remember it when I first saw it. I mean, you know, Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman, you can't do better. That's not pretty bad. Exciting. But the play is much more complicated and interesting and textured. And I think that, funnily enough, just yesterday in New York, I was giving a lecture, and I met Carol Baker, came to the lecture. Oh. And I can't, Carol. That's just a sort of mess. I think so. I think the films, although you're right that it's how a lot of people first met Williams, I think to revisit the plays and it bears much more fruit because they're deeper, they're more complex, and the language is there. You see. Williams was a great storyteller. The people who wrote those movies, because Williams didn't write them, you know, they were rewritten or adapted, they were not as good storytellers.
Do we know how he felt about them?
Yeah, he wanted the money. I mean, they sold books. I mean, in other words, it's all part of a sort of the network of his legend and fame. I mean, he cared. He got, at the time that he was writing these plays, those plays, Glass Menagerie, which is a terrible movie, Streetcar, earned the highest prices ever given for a play. He dominated the America between 1945 and 1963 or 4 entirely. I mean, as the sort of dominant storyteller in the culture.
But then as his life changed so dramatically, so did his style and approach to writing, and that didn't work for him.
Well, it did and it didn't. I mean, it didn't in the sense that he wasn't popular, but part of the problem was Williams said that the success of Glass Menagerie was providential. Not only did it open on Easter Sunday, 1945, but he knew, and he wrote to Horton Foote in 1940, that the world of their plays, the small people, the failures, the ambivalence that he trapped in his plays could not be heard in wartime. And absolutely right, because when Glass Menagerie opened, it opened 2 weeks before the end of the war. So suddenly the themes that Williams was writing about, individualism, the self, pursuit of your own desires, transformation of the self, all those themes were suddenly what obsessed America, because here they were coming back from a war, the end of a depression, in the 10 years between 45 and 55 were the highest growth in per capita income in the history of Western civilization. So these people with money, with hope, with a peace, were there to pursue their desires. And Williams' plays spoke to that yearning, which is what his plays are all about. And when he started to go off the boil as a playwright, which you mentioned, it was exactly when Vietnam started. We were back in wartime. People wanted simplicity. They wanted a political debate. They wanted to discuss the external reality. And Williams is all about an internal reality.
Yeah. You know, the backstory on the opening of Glass Menagerie, you begin your book with that. And a fascinating story that is. How about a synopsis of that?
Oh, well, basically, the part of the transformation of the resurrection of Glass Menagerie, he resurrected Williams into a great playwright, but he also resurrected the reputation of Laurette Taylor, who was a big star and turned in, as it happens, one of the great performances of the 20th century in the play. But she was an alcoholic, and she'd been banned from the theater for about a year by Equity before essentially being so drunk that the play had to be stopped. Anyway, they watched her like a hawk during rehearsals. And on the opening night, the director very smartly kept the cast rehearsing and up until 5 and went off to change for opening. And when the director came back, there was Laurette drunk outside, and they had to walk her around and put her in a shower. And when the curtain went up on this famous performance, she came out because she'd been away from the theater for a while, to a volley of applause which startled her. And when the play started, she started in the second act, not in the first. And the actor playing Tom, Eddie Dowling, who also produced and directed the play, had to get her back on track. And when she did get on track, they had a pail in the wings. She would come off, vomit into the pail, and go back out. And a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, Betsy Rice, was the understudy of that production and saw it all. So I had the good luck of my good luck as a biographer was finding the oral history that Dowling had made at Columbia, which tells all this in vivid detail, and knowing and living in the same house as Betsy Rice in London, and hearing all these things to confirm it.
Time is beginning to get away from us. There are a couple of other things I want to get to, but one of the things I wanted to mention, I'm not sure that everybody in our audience would know that you're the son of Bert Lahr, the Cowardly Lion and the Wizard of Oz, the iconic character. That's something most people don't know. How did that influence your life growing up in the midst of that kind of celebrity?
You know, it's interesting because Dad had, you know, was a vaudeville, burlesque and vaudeville star before he became a Broadway star. He wanted my sister and I to have a very comfortable life, which we, without risk. And we chose to be writers and book
which
publishers.
Which is fairly risky.
Very, as it happens. And we never knew, I never knew, that I would, that any of my childhood would be of any use to me. And growing up, I went to Yale. I was going to be a foreign correspondent, I thought. But in order to start writing, I asked if I could write his life, and he said, oh, yeah, sure, why not? So I spent 5 years writing a book on him called Notes on a Cowardly Lion, which was first published in when I was 28. I'm 74, so a long time. But what I realized as I got into it, I didn't think I was going to be a drama critic, but that all this, you know, when you grow up in a household of a star, you watch the Macy's Day Parade from Ethel Merman's house, you know. I carried Buster Keaton's ukulele to the train station.
My father knew her when she was Ethel Zimmerman,
oh,
by
there
the
you
way.
Go. Well, there you go. And, you know, and I realize how unconsciously, you know, I always had a perception of the difference in between a person's public persona and their private persona, because my father, who was sensationally fabulous on stage, was sensationally morose off it. And I, what I do in the profiles is also to look at the – try to find the essence of a person, not the public persona, so that a lot of the questions that I'm asking myself as an adult doing this job are things that come back inevitably to my own upbringing, like questions like, what is the price of fame? How can you be, honor your talent and honor your life or be good and be great? All those things, and what is, I wrote a whole book on a great comedian called Barry Humphries, who has a character called Dame Edna Everage. Maybe he played St. Louis, but a wonderful act. I wrote it from backstage because I'm very interested in that moment when the citizen, the ordinary citizen, becomes the extraordinary performer. That sort of chemistry, the interaction with the audience. All of that is, and all that's trying to look inevitably at my very lovely but distant dad. I think, you know, being writing about the theater, trying to keep the theatricals in the discussion at a time when there's hardly any drama criticism, there's the shrinking newspapers. And, you know, it's my tradition. It's a way of holding on and sustaining the tradition. And I suppose, analytically speaking, it's a way of me holding on to my dad in some way.
Is there any chance, any way that you would not have become the writer and the kind of writer you are without having been brought up in a show business family?
Well, you know, I don't – who knows? But I can tell you one thing, that what I – what I got from Dad, somebody asked me a while ago to write an article about it and I thought about it. What I got from him was sort of two things. The ambition to be excellent, and that requires an awful lot of perseverance. And also one other thing, which it's my ambition, but I could see it through him, the ambition to drive an audience crazy with pleasure. Mm-hmm. To corrupt them with pleasure. That's something that I would like to think I try to do anyway.
You think you've done it with Joyride, your latest book?
I hope so.
Tell us a little bit about it. Again, time is getting away.
Okay. Very simply, these are profiles of playwrights and directors and some of my reviews of their work. And what I'm trying to do is we usually see plays in a context of no context. And what I'm trying to do is make better audiences This is by giving people more information about the writers, how these works come about. So, for instance, I go with Arthur Miller in this book. I'm very proud of this particular essay because Miller said it was the best thing ever written about his stuff. And he takes me to the cabin which he built, having never ever built a cabin in the woods, in order to write this play that he had in mind. And he only had two lines, Willie and I've come back. That's all he had. He built the cabin, sat down, and in the first night with his tools still in the cabin, on a desk made of a drawer, he wrote the first act of Death of a Salesman. So we go through all that and analyze the evolution of the play. And I hope that you see this gives that play, Miller's centenary next year, it gives it not only more depth, but it gives the reader a sense of the expanse of the career and the psychology of the person. Anybody who wants to know about August Wilson, the greatest, in my view, one of the greatest playwrights of the century, walked with him in Pittsburgh, met the drug dealers he lived with, met his sister, and he died so suddenly that the profile, as it happens, just by the caprice of history, is the only in-depth profile that exists on him. Mm-hmm. So these things over time, I wanted to lay down these portraits of these abstract and brief chronicles of our time. You know, they are athletes of the spirit, actors and writers.
And the writers are so often forgotten. I mean, when we go to a play, we don't often or always think of the writer. When we go to a film, we don't often think
well,
of the
writer. That's exactly why a book like this is needed.
Okay. Was Tennessee Williams in competition with Arthur Miller and some of the other
Tennessee Williams was O'Neill? In competition with the world. He was very shrewd at not showing it, but his letters and diaries show that when Streetcar came out, he says in one letter, I got more copies of this review than I got of my own play. Do you know what I mean? He was sort of miffed. No, he was aware of it. He was aware, and he joked about it to a degree. Yes, he wanted to be great.
And I wonder if the others felt they were in competition with him. I'm sure they felt the same
way.
You know,
I think it's a very competitive business.
It must be.
I think O'Neill was, by the time Tennessee had his first hit, O'Neill had really retired from the theater. He was just secluding himself and writing his plays. And he didn't really have many plays on in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, in Streetcar, I mean, Long Day's Journey and Tonight, he didn't even want ever performed. So, you know, I think he was in a sort of different empyrean than Williams. But he was very much competitive with someone like Inge, who actually Williams not only gave his start to, he got him to Audrey Wood, his own agent. And then Inge had a number of hits, and Williams became jealous of his commercial success.
You know? How did he help Inge? When I think of Inge, I think of Picnic.
He helped Inge in this. Inge interviewed Williams after seeing Glass Menagerie. He was a critic and a reporter. And he had been writing sort of Noel Coward-like plays. And what Williams's plays did, and in fact, this is how he changed the action. He was crucial to changing this whole narrative style of contemporary theater. We wouldn't, for instance, have Death of a Salesman without Williams, because he showed the playwrights, besides the lyricism and the beauty of the writing, how to first speak at full voice. And also, he showed them how to both dramatize external reality and internal reality. I mean, in fact, and this is fascinating to me, Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman, was originally called Inside His Head. Mm. So it's that sort of poet breaking the sort of stranglehold of stage naturalism and being able to create a sense of the internal psychological life and the external reality is how he broke the theater open for contemporary playwrights.
That's what you were talking about when you, and I have a quote here, he released the U.S. theater from puritanical straitjackets.
Yeah, well, yes, and a kind of realism. You can see it in the painting of the 30s. He opened it up. He made it in certain ways, like in Camino Real, abstract as well, you know.
After spending all this time and all these words and all these pages writing about Tennessee Williams, do you like the guy?
Of course. I mean, he waged a heroic struggle both for his art and for his sanity. He lost, you know, he lost the battle, I guess people would say, but I don't think he did, because he left a kind of extraordinary legacy of the deliriums of the culture, including his own. He left characters in the culture, Amanda, Big Daddy, Blanche, Stanley, that transcend the stories of their plays, that live as folk figures in the culture.
Right. One final word, because our time is just about up. Did he commit suicide, do you think?
Yes. Just that simple? He overdosed, yeah.
Yeah. And there were other versions of that at the time.
They're wrong.
I'll take your word for it. Believe me, a lot of time with Tennessee.
12 years.
12 years, wow. Yeah. John Lahr, thank you so much for being with us. Wonderful book. Wonderful books, by the way. I'll point out, by the way, that the book's name that we've been talking about is Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh. The other book is Joyride. That's just out. John is lecturing at Washington University later this afternoon at 4 p.m. The subject, Tennessee Williams and the Outcrying Heart. Free event, that's always good, at the Olin Women's Building Lounge. Coming up, We Live Here with Camille Stanley. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.